Good morning, everyone. This is Deja Herbulock from the Science Media Center in New Zealand, starting our briefing on xenotransplantation today. Thank you all for dialing in and joining us. We have three speakers on our panel. The first is Professor Anthony Dapici. He's the Director of Immunology Research at St. Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne. And he is the former president of the International Xenotransplantation Association. He's been involved in xenotransplantation since 1989. Our second panelist will be Bob Elliott, the medical director and co-founder of Living Cell Technologies. Professor Elliott was trained as a pediatrician at Adelaide University and became the foundation professor at the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Auckland. Our third panelist is bioethicist Martin Wilkinson. He is currently in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Auckland. He chaired the New Zealand Bioethics Council from 2006 to 2009, and when that council was examining the issue of xenotransplantation, he was chair of their working party back in 2005. He's a political theorist by training and has worked in bioethics for the last 10 years. So the way that this conference will work, I will be muting all the participants during the presentations themselves, but at the end I will open things up for questions from the audience. So in the meantime, there is a chat box on the left side if thoughts occur to you during presentations and you want to note them down, and I will come back with further instructions for the question and answer once we get to that stage. But I'd like to start things out with Professor Anthony Dapici.
Hi. Now, are you going to fire up my slides or do I fire them up?
You can go ahead and run them yourself.
Okay. All right. So I just thought I'd, for those who are not really cognizant of xenotransplantation, go through just some background. So this slide just is a simple statement about what xenotransplantation is. And it's the transplantation of living, and that's the key word, living cells, tissues and organs from one species to another. So things like pickled heart valves or tendons do not qualify. Clinical xenotransplantation has been performed many times in the past, but without lasting success, and that's predominantly or almost exclusively due to rejection. And so this era, if you like, is an era where we're looking to clinical success as distinct from just attempts that have been made in the past. Unlike the past, the pig is the currently preferred donor. In the past, people were looking at primates because they're closer to humans genetically, that they would be suitable. But primates are unsafe due to the risk of lethal infection. So we're looking at pig to human grafts. Now, the types of xenotransplantation fall roughly into two broad groups: vascularized organs, in other words, ones with a blood supply connected to the human blood supply, like the kidney or the heart or the liver, are one group, and the other group are cells, and that's what Bob Elliott's here to talk about today, pancreatic islet cells for type 1 diabetes. There are two broad categories of these, either infused directly into the patient, and the site optimal site today is into the portal blood system, in other words, up into the liver, and that's sort of, if you like, raw islets or uncoated islets going straight into the liver. And what Bob's going to be talking about are encapsulated islets, but others have used other forms of devices, if you like, other ways of isolating the islets from the circulation. And other cells that have been considered are neurons for Parkinson's disease, and this is direct implantation into the brain. That's not relevant to today, but it's been experimentally studied in the United States. The donor pigs that fall into a number of categories: normal pigs, which is what Bob will be using, genetically modified pigs, which are essential for organ transplants. In other words, where they're vascularized, where the pig tissue directly is exposed to human blood, you have to genetically modify them to remove pig antigens and to add in human regulators of both complement and coagulation. And so that these various genetic modifications are predominantly were done in our laboratories here in Melbourne and around Australia. The pigs must be what are called specific or defined pathogen-free and kept in isolation. And I'm sure Bob will be talking to you about that. The prevention of rejection can be via a number of not mutually exclusive approaches. Genetic modification of the donor pig and multiple modifications are possible, and that I've mentioned there. That's removal of pig type genes to remove a target of the human immune response or to add in human molecules that regulate the human immune response. Immunosuppression, in other words, drugs which are systemically applied to the patient to prevent rejection, or physical methods such as encapsulation that Bob will be discussing with you. The regulatory issues I don't want to go into in enormous detail, but the central issue in all of this is risk-benefit. And so it's about minimising risk, the risk of failure, such as graft loss, the risk of infection, which is not just a problem for the patient, but possibly for their contacts and for the community. And that may be infection with known or unknown organisms, and including this one that's heated much discussion, porcine endogenous retrovirus. And also minimising risk from immunosuppression. The distance between a pig and a human is substantial. The amount of immunosuppression that potentially is required could be substantial. And so approaches to minimise the amount of immunosuppression required and therefore the deleterious effects on the recipient are relevant. Maximising benefit, on the other hand, is about cure or amelioration of organ failure. So that we want to minimise the risk, maximise the benefit. That's pretty straightforward. The various authorities throughout the world have either provided guidelines or advice on regulation, on how xenotransplantation might come to be in various areas. And what I've done here is just for the sake of people who want to look this up, given some websites that get you into this. The WHO, the International Xenotransplant Association, of which I've been president and on their ethics committee, have had quite a lot to contribute to what we believe to be required before clinical application of xenotransplantation goes ahead, and the FDA, which is regulating xenotransplantation in the United States. I'll mention, just for those who are interested, that Australia still has a moratorium on xenotransplantation, and that's in the hands of the NHMRC, and that is going to be reconsidered later this year. I think I'll leave it there and hand over to, I think, Bob is next.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Handing over now to Bob Elliott.
Okay. I speak on behalf of Living Cell Technologies, which is a listed company on the Australian Stock Exchange with its major activities, scientific activities, based in New Zealand. I won't dwell on too much on my first slide, which is pretty much the same as Anthony was talking about. I'm really going to define xenotransplantation here in a clinical sense as transplanting living animal cells, tissues or organs into humans with the relevant diseases, that there is a distinct therapeutic attempt here. And the two examples I could give there that we are currently engaged in are pig insulin-producing cells into insulin-deficient diabetics, or more recently, pig choroid plexus cells into the brains of Parkinson's sufferers. So these are possible new ways of treating these diseases. Now, I'm going to concentrate entirely upon the first of those examples, the pig insulin-producing cells into insulin-dependent or deficient diabetics. As you all know, the hallmark of type 1 diabetes is the destruction of the person's own insulin-producing cells, and the simplistic approach is to replace them with living cells which behave the same way as their own destroyed insulin-producing cells did before they were destroyed. This is instead of multiple injections of insulin and trying to get the dose right by measuring blood glucose levels. It's a different approach to the treatment of type 1 diabetes. Now, the principal risks are, as Anthony said, infection with a known or unknown agent. And I'd like briefly just to point that we have looked at this very intently, and we have reduced the likelihood of this occurring to a vanishingly small number by herd selection. We're using a herd of pigs which have no known agent capable of infecting man. And these animals also do not produce infective endogenous retroviral particles, nor is that the genomic provirus, if it were expressed, capable of recombination. It's something to do with the way in which that particular genomic provirus is put together. We monitor these pigs regularly. They are housed in an environment which does not permit the entry of external organisms, except perhaps through the attendants, and they are thoroughly vetted and must shower in and garb up in sterile clothing and so on, and sterile water, sterile bedding, sterile food, and HEPA filtered air going in under positive pressure into the facility. There is a real risk of introducing infections during the processing of the pancreases from these animals. That has occurred in the past with human islet transplantation. So these must be done under a very strict situation in a licensed good manufacturing premise facility. Now, that's the principal risk, and that's got to be balanced up against the possible benefit. And as Anthony said, there is this problem of almost immediate rejection if you put just ordinary, normal pig insulin-producing cells into a human. They'll be rejected within seconds or minutes, at any rate. And we have chosen to avoid that rejection by coating them with a material which allows the insulin out and nutrients in, but prevents the antibodies and cells of the immune system entering and killing these cells off. That's called microencapsulation, and that's taken us a long time to perfect. It's a technique that's been around for many decades, but has failed to live up to its expectations, mainly due to problems with the materials and so on. So we've spent a lot of time, a lot of money with material scientists to overcome those problems. Now, using those microencapsulated pig insulin-producing cells, we have in a pilot study where we've injected these into the peritoneal cavity, the belly cavity of type 1 diabetics, adult type 1 diabetics, that two of those have shown sustained insulin independence following that procedure. One of those, our best patient so far, is still insulin independent 6 months after her injection of these cells. How much longer this will go, we don't know, but we have high hopes as a result of an earlier study done back in 1995, where using a prototype, we're able to demonstrate residual insulin-producing cells after 9.5 years into the peritoneal cavity. And just to show you some of the results we've had with those patients, these are that circle there is a one of these capsules, microcapsules containing that black cluster of cells that are the insulin-producing cells, recovered 18 months after they'd been put into the peritoneal cavity. And that green cluster is that same cluster stained up to show that they are viable and still making insulin 18 months later from one of the patients. Okay, and now furthermore, we were able in one of these patients who was off insulin to measure pig insulin in the blood. This is a highly specialised technique, and we were able to show only pig insulin in her blood on two occasions there, and she was not taking any other insulin at all. So she was not taking any insulin for the reason that she was making pig insulin. Now, my conclusions out of all this is that it is possible to do cellular transplants using pig cells. We have demonstrated in preliminary studies benefit, and then it's a hypothetical risk only, and we provided stringent precautions are taken. We believe this is a vanishingly small risk and a demonstrated benefit. Therefore, we achieve what is required in terms of going ahead with a further clinical trial. And I can now tell you that in New Zealand, as of yesterday, we have approval from the New Zealand government to proceed with a clinical trial, and that's underway today. We have fulfilled all of the requirements which I have been looking at over the last 3.5 years. The application has been in, but we have satisfied their requirements. I could ask them, why is there a moratorium on clinical trials in Australia, Canada, a few other places? This might be suggested is now unreasonable, and I believe you could go a little further than that and saying that a moratorium which doesn't allow a clinical trial under suitable precautionary circumstances is failing in the duty of care, which isn't just that of physicians or researchers towards the community, but also includes regulators. I'm going to conclude there. I will have to put up as part of the company policy a safe harbour statement and listing on the ASX. Okay, I'm finished.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob Elliott. And we'll now hand over to our final panellist, Martin Wilkinson.
Hi. I'm just going to run over some of the ethical issues in a nutshell and then say something very briefly at the end about how Biotis Council engaged in its public deliberation. So if we answer, well, what are the possible ethical problems with xenotransplantation? The first is we might realise that xenotransplantation is a matter of research now rather than a clinical application, and there's certain standard rules for ethical research. One rule is that research should be in equipoise, which is a jargon term for saying that if you're going to try something out on someone in a trial, what you're trying out on them should be expected to be neither better nor worse than their best alternative. And the other obvious standard rule is that subjects are supposed to give free, informed consent. Now, it's certainly possible that a xenotransplantation trial could violate both of those rules. So, for instance, if you were to try something out on people that really has got no chance at all compared with their alternative, then that would violate equipoise, and possibly some of the early xenotransplantations with organs would have violated that kind of rule. It's also possible that subjects are so desperate that they will agree to be in anything without actually properly considering the real risks and benefits. But these problems, the problem of equipoise and the problem of consent, are generic problems within research ethics. They don't only arise for xenotransplantation. And there's a whole elaborate research ethics framework in developed countries, which of course includes Australia and New Zealand. And so if these are problems, these are problems that can be handled by the existing framework. A second kind of objection that's sometimes made is one that will be familiar to many of you who've worked on in bioethics. This is a plain God objection or an acting against nature objection. So because xenotransplantation mixes up material from different species, some people think that this is wrong in some sort of way, that it's a sort of piece of human arrogance or it's unnatural. I can't disguise my disbelief in this objection. The people who make it never really explain what the difference is between doing this and using antibiotics to treat a staph infection, for instance, or indeed having a roof to stop rain falling down one's neck, which could equally be seen as playing God or interfering with nature. Perhaps the striking thing here is that I think many people expected when we engaged in our deliberations a few years ago now that a lot of people would make this kind of point, and some did, but very few people thought that it was so wrong to play God that other people should be stopped from receiving xenotransplantation. So the people who did think there was something wrong with it thought it meant that they wouldn't do it themselves, but they didn't think that it followed that the regulator should step in and prevent others from doing it. Moving next to what I think is a serious question, and this is about the interests of animals. Obviously, put as an objection in the quotation marks there, we could say that xenotransplantation harms the animals, both those who are used as the subjects. So when research is tried out, it's often tried out on animals, usually tried out on animals before it's tried out on humans. And obviously, animals are also the raw material for xenotransplantation, like pigs that Bob Elliott's been talking about. And so there the thought is, well, you shouldn't do this sort of research on animals. Now, I must say, I think this is a serious objection, and there's at least two ways to take it. One is to raise a whole fundamental question about the morality of using animals in this sort of way. And the second one is about the adequacy of the animal welfare regulatory system. So a lot of the people who raised the objections were objecting actually to the regulatory system, which they thought wasn't transparent enough. I don't really have any comment on either of those that I can usefully make in this time, other than to say that the issues they raise are common across much medical and scientific research. So a lot of, obviously, as I said, a lot of medical and scientific research uses animals anyway. And without wanting to say that it's right or wrong, there's nothing special here about xenotransplantation. Where I think the really serious question arises about the ethics of xenotransplantation that does make it different is the risk of contagious disease that the other two presenters have talked about. Because xenotransplantation raises at least the possibility of a disease spreading from the recipient to other people, this makes it, as a clinical treatment or as a research trial, different from others, because the people who are affected are no longer just those people who are consenting. So ordinarily, if you were, say, to receive some trial of a cancer drug and you were going to be a subject, then it would be up to you whether you're in it or not, but it would have nothing to do with me, who's in no way connected with you. Here the thought is that because of the disease risk, xenotransplantation can't be regarded as purely a matter to be conducted between the researchers and the subjects. Other people themselves have a legitimate interest in not being infected. Having said that, we have to be careful what conclusions we draw from it. First of all, the risk of disease from xenotransplantation is highly variable according to the sort of xenotransplantation it is. So transplanting a baboon's heart is much riskier than transplanting porcine islet cells. The second point to make is that every society tolerates some people imposing risks on other people. So, for instance, every time you go for a drive, you impose a non-zero risk of hitting some other non-consenting person. Every time people go flying, particularly nowadays with jets, this is a potential way of spreading disease, as, of course, we all know since we're in a pandemic. But no society concludes on the basis of this that we should ban all car travel or that we should ban all jet travel. So, in effect, what society is doing is making some kind of judgment that some risks can be tolerated and managed rather than reacting to the possibility of risk by a flat-out ban. So the conclusion, I think, there is that for some types of xenotransplantation, perhaps not all, the risk is low enough to be managed rather than having xenotransplantation banned. What we might do, and this is what the Biotech Council recommended, is that because of the disease risk of xenotransplantation, there may be some restrictions that are justified on xenotransplantation recipients that would not be justified on people in the normal course of events. So we recommend that there should be some kind of register set up to keep track of people who've received xenografts, possibly people who have been in subjects of trials shouldn't be allowed to withdraw their data. Possibly people should be have to go through routine monitoring to see if they have symptoms. So here, actually, the thought is that there's some ways of managing this. This may justify, as long as it's made clear to subjects up front, some extra kind of restrictions that normally wouldn't happen. Still, though, no conclusion at this stage that it should be banned just because of the possibility of risk. So finally, if I want to talk about a deliberative process, we ran a large-scale deliberative process in 2005 in all sorts of fancy and complicated ways that I'm happy to talk about if anyone wants to ask. And what we found is that, by and large, the public would be willing to let xenotransplantation proceed so long as there were adequate safety, animal welfare, and ethical regulation. It's very clear that our process and our report recommending that the xenotransplantation shouldn't be banned did play a substantial role in the decision to allow it to go ahead in New Zealand. There's a lesson here, I think, which is that the deliberation not only has democratic advantages, but it helps with getting a policy like this across. So some people did think that any sort of deliberation is just a way of inviting the public to go yuck and stopping things. That wasn't our experience with xenotransplantation, and it hasn't been our experience in other kinds of areas either. Maybe there's a lesson for other countries here. Anyway, that's my presentation.